Good morning.
Good morning, Counsel.
May it please the Court. The Court has essentially two cases in front of it, or certainly two versions of events in front of it. The first is a series of contracts and agreements that were signed, and what those claim and what those state, some of which were sworn affidavits executed in front of the notary public. And then the version 4 to 6 years later, when somebody testified directly contrary to what was in those contracts and said, well, none of that was true. And the consistent basis for saying that was, I did not read the contracts. That is the entire defense throughout. I did not read the contracts. So you should believe what I'm saying 4 to 6 years later, because I did not read the contracts in the first
instance. Isn't this an appeal from a jury?
It is, Your Honor. And I'll get to that momentarily. The first issue I want to address is that the jurisdictional issue. And the jurisdictional issue that's before the Court, we raised this in our brief, and we also pointed this out in the Rule 28J letter, is when jurisdiction, when standing is challenged on appeal, then there's a shift in the burden of proof. And the burden of proof goes to the other party whose standing or jurisdiction has been challenged to establish that he or she had jurisdiction by pointing to evidence adduced at trial to establish that jurisdiction. We did that in our brief. In response, the appellees came back and cited some hornbook law on what jurisdiction is generally, but they certainly did not point anywhere in the record, and particularly important, they ignored the authorities we cited, specifically Jones and Associates Incorporated versus District of Columbia, wherein the Court held, and it cited cases from the D.C. Court of Appeals going back to 1999, that Dr. Kartenauer had to prove that he sustained a special injury, which is to say he had to prove that he sustained an injury that is different from the injury that was sustained by the partnership.
But there are only two partners here.
That's correct.
So, I mean, necessarily, if Robertson is doing the tortious activity, he has a special injury. I mean, there's only two of them.
I disagree, Your Honor, for the following reason. If you look at the Jones and Associates case versus District of Columbia, and you look at the D.C. statutes, which we cited, there's a difference between a partner and a partnership. And that's a corporate formality that has been consistently ignored thus far. Dr. Kartenauer is a partner, but he is not the partnership. And what happened here, and I think the factual background is significant on this point, is that an involuntary bankruptcy petition was filed by one of the unpaid creditors against the partnership. The partnership went into bankruptcy, and in an effort to avoid the bankruptcy stay, and we noted this in our opening brief, they dropped their derivative claims on behalf of the partnership. That was a tactical maneuver. They were trying to evade the jurisdiction of the bankruptcy court, but what they did was outmaneuver themselves.
Because they being?
I'm sorry, the appellees. The appellees, or Dr. I'm sorry, no, I'm sorry. Dr. Kartenauer, Your Honor. Dr. Kartenauer, by dropping his derivative claims, dropping the claims for the injuries to the partnership, made a tactical decision to try to avoid the bankruptcy court, and in the process of doing that, he avoided, or he dropped all the claims that relate to the injuries to the partnership. But again, as a legal matter, Your Honor, under this case we cited, Jones and Associates, and also under the D.C. statutes, there is a fundamental difference between a partner and the partnership. The one specific document I would point the court to is jury instruction number 23, which is in the appendix at 1051, where, and this is just one example, in the instructions to the jury, it says that Dr. Kartenauer has asserted three claims for damages against Mr. Robertson arising from their partnership in WAR LLP. So again, to make this perfectly clear, everything here pertains to the claims arising from the partnership. This is not just two individuals and my client backs into Dr. Kartenauer's car and they have a separate claim. These are all claims arising from the partnership and involving injuries to the partnership. Going back to some of the core issues in the dispute here, Dr. Kartenauer has been arguing consistently that he was unrepresented by counsel. And again, this is where his testimony conflicts with the undisputed documents that he signed. He signed the partnership agreement in 2004 stating that
undisputed documents. That's what his testimony, because his testimony conflicts with it. They are just
the version of events is viewed. What did not happen? These documents were never rescinded. They were not set aside by the court. He never contested that he signed the documents.
Right.
All he's saying
is the content, the veracity of them.
Right. He's saying, I signed this document, but I didn't read it. Therefore, you can't hold that document against me. That's the argument. And so with respect to this issue, he met with an attorney, or according to the document, the attorney advised him, do not enter the partnership. In the partnership agreement, he acknowledges all that and says he chose to enter the partnership agreement anyway. The partnership agreement also said he had an ongoing duty to consult with outside counsel. But when he got to trial, he testified that, no, he actually never had consulted with outside counsel. And we mentioned this, or emphasized it particularly in the reply brief, and that is the issue of Larry Ashe. We actually built the perjury trap, or trial counsel built the perjury trap and proved that he had, in fact, consulted with outside counsel, namely Larry Ashe. And we pointed to some of the evidence in the record where Dr. Cartonaro admitted, yes, I should have disclosed that in discovery. And we also asked you to take judicial notice of some additional information pertaining to Larry Ashe. And the reason we did that is just to show you, this is not some oops mistake we overlooked Larry Ashe. This is not some, oh yeah, we forgot about him. There was extensive email between Larry Ashe and the counsel for Dr. Cartonaro. They knew about him, and if you look through all the discovery requests, there is no question they had a duty to disclose him, that his identity was requested, and they withheld that from the court. That's a serious, serious matter.
When did he acknowledge that he should have mentioned this?
That was in his testimony, I believe, the pretrial deposition. I can pull that up on.
So if it came to light pretrial, what harm did you incur?
Well, the point I'm making, Your Honor, is simply that the issue here is the dispute between the contracts versus what he actually said. There is a matter of law, and we cited a raft of cases.
But then what's the relevance of Mr. Ashe?
Pardon?
Then why is Mr. Ashe relevant? I'm not following the argument.
It's relevant only to show that no party should have to go to these lengths to prove that the contract was, in fact, true. That's the point I'm trying to make. My client should have actually been to do just that and say, the contract says this. You signed it. But we went the extra mile, extra 10 miles, and said, actually, what the contract said is true. We shouldn't have to go to, no party should have to go to those lengths to prove that what the contract is saying is true. That's my point. The other argument he makes is that he thought my client was his attorney. The problem, again, going back to the contracts, in the original partnership agreement in 2004, the partnership agreement says that my client was not and could not be his attorney as long as the partnership was in existence.
Isn't it always the case that a contract that's fraudulently induced can be avoided?
Glad you asked that, Your Honor. That's where they tried to go with the trial court. They tried to argue fraudulent inducement. They wanted to have all these contracts set aside. They lost. The jury did not find fraud. And that's where their whole case blew up, essentially. They were trying to have all these agreements, the partnership agreement and everything that followed, set aside.
They found that the release and so on were not valid, correct?
That's a contract interpretation issue that I would submit as for the court.
It's the bottom line, valid or not valid. Right? They're not saying they're interpreting a word one way or another. They're saying it's not valid.
Only with respect to one agreement.
I don't know how they could reach the conclusion it's not valid unless it was on the theory that it was fraudulently induced. And there was another theory, was there?
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. There was specifically a claim related to fraud and fraudulent inducement that was found against them. The specific issue you're talking about is one agreement. You're only talking about one agreement. That's the release.
There's a jury finding on that?
Correct. The jury found there was no fraud.
Okay. Well, can you just refresh me on that? Where is it?
If I may, Your Honor, I'll reserve time and then come back up on a reply and point you to that in the record.
All right.
And actually, Your Honor, I'll go ahead and reserve my time now, and then I'll bring that back up. Thank you.
Okay. Good morning. May it please the Court. Patrick Kearney on behalf of William Cartonhauer. This is a case where a jury awarded Dr. Cartonhauer $3.5 million in actual damages and $3.5 million in punitive damages because it easily found lies and dishonesty from the man who owed the highest duty of good faith and fair dealing, Wade Robertson. And they found that from start to finish. The standing issue is a red herring. The injury, in fact, happened when Mr. Robertson put his hand into Dr. Cartonhauer's pocket, took the $3.5 million, and walked away with it. It's the money that he took, he put it in the partnership, but it's the actual taking of the money. That's the injury in fact. But what the jury had in this case was dishonesty at the beginning, at the middle, and the end of the relationship. In the original agreement states that Dr. Kartenhauer reviewed it with an attorney, and the attorney advised him not to enter into the partnership. Their witness, Larry Ash, specifically testified, and this is at Appendix 0578 through 82. He never talked about a partnership with Dr. Kartenhauer. He had reviewed something called a prospectus. It was a very narrow document, so he never saw it. What else was a lie? The attestation of no attorney-client relationship signed in April of 2006. It's not true. You can tell from their own brief. Robertson wrote the document. Robertson wrote a codicil to a will. He wrote a will. He wrote the dissolution of a business called TCT. He wrote the amended partnership agreement in December 2005 to address succession concerns because Dr. Kartenhauer is a frail old man. He also gave legal advice in May 2006 to put the will in the safe deposit box, tell him how to destroy it, looking into registering the will. He gave legal advice about how the partnership was going to go. In a letter written March 4, 2005 from Mr. Robertson to Dr. Kartenhauer, in fact, in our estimation, the testimony likely makes our case unbeatable. And then he goes to explain the law of spoliation of evidence, something a non-legal person isn't going to understand. On a letter that's on Mr. Robertson's legal letterhead that says attorney-client privileged. And he was dishonest with a lack of information the entire time. Dr. Kartenhauer puts his $1 million in. Within a month, Mr. Robertson took out $970,000. When the accounting time came due in March 2005, after he sunk his hooks in and said, we're going to get some more money out of you, Dr. Kartenhauer, he writes a letter saying, the capital has been preserved. Didn't say, I lent myself $970,000. Indeed, he actually takes the 970, puts it back into the bank account. Money's all there. Dr. Kartenhauer invests another $1 million on April 5, 2005, 4 days after the Lew litigation. The underlying litigation was dismissed. On April 8th, Mr. Robertson took out a loan, $1,970,000, no interest, not payable until 2030. No disclosure of this fact. When Dr. Kartenhauer finally has the light come on in 2007 and writes John Watts, the class action attorney, and says, what's going on here? Mr. Robertson's first reaction isn't to contact Dr. Kartenhauer and say, let's talk about this and work this out. His first reaction was to take $1,435,000 out of the partnership account, put it into his pocket, sign a promissory note, no interest, not payable until 2040. There's lack of honesty and disclosure about the Lew case. Mr. Robertson wrote a letter, June 27, 2005. All is on track. The Lew case was dismissed April 1st. On May 16, their first motion for reconsideration was denied. The judge said the case is doomed on the third amended complaint. It wasn't until September 6, 2005, he writes a very long letter. There's been a snag, a recent snag. The recent snag was 5 months ago. And the snag's just procedural. Well, it's not procedural. It was a securities case, and he couldn't plead loss causation. It's a very sophisticated concept. Most people aren't going to understand the loss causation issue. Kartenhauer has no idea about it. But then he goes on to explain, I objectively believe the case is going to be wildly successful, and we're going to make lots of money. He didn't tell him that the case was lost and they were dead unless the Second Circuit turned it around for them. On March 15, 2006, just before the last investment, he sends a letter that says has a Second Circuit brief on it, their appellant brief. But the cover letter says, our case continues to grow stronger. It doesn't say that we think we got a good argument, but we're going to lose this case. Dr. Kartenhauer, Mr. Robertson was a fiduciary. He recognized it. He wrote a letter on November 15, 2004 and said, first, let me assure you that any time there's a development, whether positive or negative, that is reasonably material to the outcome of the case, I will promptly notify and disclose you. That's how partnerships work. That's what fiduciary duties are all about. There's a raft of cases, and we always go back to Cardozo on what fiduciary duties are like, but the District of Columbia still recognizes it. Marmack versus Wolpe, that's a case involving a guy who took a 3.5% commission and sold a multi-million dollar property, and his partners were upset. The partnership agreement said that they could take a commission. He said he was taking a commission. For some reason, they never discussed what the commission was. And the D.C. Court of Appeals said, well, the duty to account is, in fact, a fiduciary duty. But you guys all knew what was happening, and you made a lot of money for your partners. So they kind of hinged a little bit on that, but they came down with the basic statement. If you go to the D.C. Code, 33104.4D, states the same Cardozo statement. Good faith and fair dealing has to go all the way through. The release. The release is a global release. You can't sue before, can't sue after. And Mr. Robertson specifically testified on the stand. His understanding was, even if he made $1 billion in the Lew litigation and decided not to turn it over, he couldn't be sued. The jury found that it wasn't a contract. There's no recitation of consideration. There's nothing to show what Dr. Kartenhauer was getting in return for signing the release. And in fact, the only thing he got was the ability to put $1.5 million into Mr. Robertson's pocket the next day. The jury found undue influence. The jury found it was unconscionable. And the two kind of go hand in hand, the court's decision, this court's decision, Williams versus Walker Thomas Furniture, the terms are unreasonable. Just anybody who looks at it, the guy gives up everything for anything. Then you have to look at whether he has meaningful choice or not. And that's a jury determination. Whether or not his bargaining power was so unequal, or whether he was so under the spell of this man, that there could be anything that would give him a meaningful choice. And as to fraud, with respect to the release only, the jury did find that there was no fraudulent inducement. It's in the jury,
yes,
specific jury findings.
Undue influence, unconscionability instead.
Yes, they did find undue influence and unconscionability, Your Honor. But they also found it wasn't a contract. As to the statute of limitations that was argued, the discovery rule is a fact-specific issue. Dr. Kartenhauer said he had no idea, and if you look at the correspondence, it's clear he had no idea. He wrote a letter to Mr. Robertson in November 2006, I depend upon you, or we depend upon you, to know what's going on and whether this case is going to settle. Within the 3 years of the filing of the case, he still had absolutely no idea. I would refer to the court to Ray versus Queen for the type of facts that go into that. In Ray versus Queen, a lady settled her husband's wrongful death suit. The children should have gotten most of the money under the intestate laws. She kept it for herself and signed an agreement with the attorney that she'd indemnify him in case they ever found out about and sued him. And the attorney said, well, 3 years have gone by. And they should have known because it was a big pot of money and they only got a couple of bucks. And they asked their mother and their mother didn't respond. The D.C. Court of Appeals specifically said that was a fact issue. The jury had to figure out whether or not they actually knew about the injury, in fact, and knew enough of the facts to decide whether or not the statute of limitations ran. Your Honor, people make fun of attorneys all the time, but to whom do they turn? Who do they trust? They trust attorneys. That's what we have. We trust attorneys. We trust our fiduciaries. Mr. Robertson found an old vulnerable man who took him in hook, line, and sinker and preyed upon him. The jury correctly found that there was damages of $3.5 million in punitives, and therefore we ask the court to affirm.
Thank you. How much time did counsel have left?
He has 1 minute.
All right.
Members of the court, I'm going to go briefly through the issues that were waived. First of all, we argued in our brief that the trial court committed reversible error by excluding evidence of services to the partnership. They did not respond to that, and they waived it. And this goes to some of the things that Mr. Mr. Kearney was just now arguing about. He was saying that my client took $3.5 million and provided no services to the partnership. We tried to introduce the evidence of the work that he did, specifically all the timesheets, the $3.8 million worth of legal services, 7,900 hours worth of legal services that he provided, and the trial court excluded that. We said that's reversible error. It's outcome determinative. They didn't dispute that. We are
7,900 hours that Robertson provided?
Correct.
But he wasn't the attorney.
He was for, in his separate litigation. He's not the attorney. That's the partnership.
Okay.
He's not the attorney for Dr. Kartenhauer. He's representing legal matters on behalf of the partnership.
Right.
The other is that we argued that the trial court erred by refusing a jury instruction on the damages offset. They conceded that. No, there was no, she did not allow that. We said that's error. They didn't dispute it. I see that my time is up. And thank you.
Thank you, counsel.